Podcast Ain't Play Nobody. Real quick before we start the show, I want to be clear and kind of give a little trigger warning to you if you are someone who is sensitive to descriptions of the legalities around sexual assault. We are going to get into a little bit of what happened at Michigan State in 2017. And if you're someone who's sensitive to that, I just want to make clear that you should probably skip from minute 7 to around 10:30. That's the time frame where we'll be discussing that stuff. All right, Bud. Mark D'Antonio resigns February 4th, the day before Legacy Signing Day, February Signing Day, whatever you want to call it. It came out of nowhere by all accounts. Quickly, where does Michigan State go from here? With our therapy words, I think I feel I know. I think the tires of Luke Fickell and Pat Narduzzi are going to be kicked on this. Luke Fickell at Cincinnati and Pat Narduzzi, obviously Pitt head coach, former Michigan State defensive coordinator. I think Michigan State could do a lot worse than Chris Creighton at Eastern Michigan as well. You have kind of your own name to kind of, you know, an I feel. And we talked about it before the show that I think could be really interesting for the job as well.
I fully agree with all the names you threw out there. I'm going to throw out an I feel, and this is not a I feel they will get this person, but this is an I feel they should at least go after this person, and that would be Matt Campbell at Iowa State. They're in a weird spot here timing-wise, though. Like they don't have the same leverage, I don't believe, that they might have had if they had opened earlier in the cycle. But this was actually a pretty good cycle to hire coaches in, but like this is a really difficult time to hire somebody. I mean, it's signing day is literally today.
Recording this, the 5th.
This was out of nowhere because D'Antonio was still employed by a certain point. Like I don't if he had stepped down December 1,
right,
none of us who co-host the show, I don't think would have been that shocked.
Right.
But because it went past early signing period, which totally sucks for those kids, I know we'll get to that, who signed with him. Now I think it is really a pretty big surprise. I was shocked yesterday when the news came out.
Yeah, you know, it's from all accounts, it does sound like D'Antonio left. I mean, it really sounds like D'Antonio retired in a sense of it took everybody kind of off guard. And if you were gonna retire premeditatively, it would have happened, like you said, December 1st. It does not make a ton of sense to leave February 1st, but yes, he secured the bag.
Yes, he did secure the bag, and it does make me wonder, okay, he had to stay on till what, the 15th to get the extra?
January 15th. Mark D'Antonio has, or I guess had, a contract that basically rolls over every year if he's employed at a certain date, and that date is roughly mid-January. He obviously was employed mid-January, and he got that $4.3 or $4.6 million. He got all of it, and it doesn't sound like Michigan State's going to come for it because I think D'Antonio is going to stay on staff at the school in some way, shape, or form.
There's a lot of reasons why Michigan State would not try to come for that money, as we'll get to in a minute. That I'm sure Michigan State would like if D'Antonio has a solid opinion of Michigan State and is continue to be hopeful for the future of that Michigan State program. My guess is that he would not be coming for that money. I can't fault anybody for securing the bag, right? You got to feed the fam. But, like, do we even know if Michigan State, like, were they in on this? Do you think his bosses knew he was going to do this and be like, yeah, like, we'll let you go ahead and do this and stay on so you can get your bonus and then you can walk?
Well, you know, it depends. Like, we are going, like, I'm going to get to some of the other context around D'Antonio's firing that I think is important. But I do want to talk about some of the institutional stuff around D'Antonio in a sense of, were they aware that he was going to leave? Is this a push-out situation? Is this a forced retirement situation, which obviously D'Antonio denied? He says that this is a celebration of his career yesterday at the press conference that preceded a basketball game. But, you know, Dan Murphy of ESPN, I believe, reported that the coaches, his assistant coaches, were caught off guard. D'Antonio said that he started crafting this statement a week ago. You cannot sit here though and say the timing of this isn't strange. And that's why I don't think a lot of people are taking this, you know, at face value for a lot of reasons. But even before we get to some of the reasons we're about to get to, it's the day before signing day. Like, wait, what?
Right. Also, he might have done his guys on staff a real solid in that I think the timing of this drastically increases the chance that they're able to stay on staff and that perhaps Michigan State makes an internal hire.
Just punts on this year.
Yeah, at least for this year, right? And if that guy does really well, then, you know, maybe they keep the staff on. My guess is that long-term they won't keep the whole staff on. I would think they'd want to sort of reset. But if you're D'Antonio, you're like, okay, I'm going to take care of the people who really have taken care of me. That would be the admin who's had my back. I'm going to take care of myself and get that bag, and I'm going to take care of my assistants and try to retire at the last possible minute, which makes it almost impossible to fire them for the upcoming year.
Mike Tressel is the interim head coach there. Yes, son of Jim. That is where the conspiracy theory comes from, that Jim Tressel will be the next Michigan State head coach. Obviously, D'Antonio coached under Jim at Ohio State back in the early 2000s. But I want to go into some of the other context around his resigning, retirement, you know, whatever you want to call it. We would be remiss if we didn't. There are two, I guess, semi-concurrent sexual assault investigations into four players. This goes back to 2017. I'm going to hit the broad strokes of it here, but if you want to know some more, a good place to start is the excellent MLive.com timeline of these investigations that go into a lot more detail. But the first one looked into three players stemming from a sexual assault complaint in January of 2017. Donnie Corley, Josh King, and Demetric Vance were all charged. They ended up getting a plea deal to a lesser charge of felony seduction. The woman who filed the complaint said that she agreed to a plea deal for the sake of her own mental health. All three men were initially suspended and later kicked off the team when they were formally charged in June of 2017. D'Antonio was later found to have no wrongdoing by an external investigation. February 14th of 2017, Michigan State staffer Curtis Blackwell was suspended. He was, I guess, a recruiting liaison is what you call it. Basically, he had ties to the Detroit area and was kind of Michigan State's guy in that area and helping Michigan State recruit and get players there.
And he had started... he co-founded Sound Mind, Sound Body, which was like a development program. I know they had like a 7-on deal. They had camps and stuff. It was pretty, like, as far as these things go, it was a fairly like well-known high school student development organization.
Right, right. And you said you met Blackwell once at a camp.
Yeah. I've met him one time, I believe. I don't think we were not tight or anything.
Right, right. But he had been with the team for 4 years up until that point. We'll come back to Curtis Blackwell in a second. But in April of 2017, Austin Robertson was charged with criminal sexual conduct. He was kicked off the team and later pled guilty to one count of assault with intent to commit sexual penetration. He came to Michigan State with prior sexual misconduct, and he was in the recruiting class that all four of these players were in, which I believe was called like the Dream Team or something. It was big for Michigan State, and Michigan State admitted him into school anyway. D'Antonio kind of defended the processes that went into that decision. And then in May of 2017, Blackwell was fired by D'Antonio, and an external investigation found that he allegedly did not report the news about the January 2017, he being Blackwell, did not report the news and didn't run it up the flagpole, the January 2017 sexual assault complaint, etc. Now, all of this in 2017, by the way, is in the context of the broader Larry Nassar scandal with the hundreds of gymnasts who were assaulted over years by Larry Nassar, the trainer at Michigan State. That scandal saw the athletic director resign as well as the interim president. Michigan State had like three presidents in the span of 18 months. All of this is to say that the context surrounding Michigan State is that it is an absolute mess that doesn't get near the fact that the team on the field had been diminishing returns since Narduzzi left as defensive coordinator in 2015 after the playoff year. They started diminishing returns. And Bud, I'm kind of bringing you back in here. You know, I talked to one guy last night, an agent. I was like, look, it's an absolute mess. You know, would you really want to place a head coach there? Kind of asked him the question. And he was like, not really, given everything that's gone on and the state of the administration and all that sort of stuff, that notwithstanding the fact that, you know, the sun, moon, and stars of the state is your rival team and you're in the harder part of that division. All of that, you know, confluence is the reason why Michigan State kind of is in the position that they are right now.
Yeah, this was an interesting thing that went on there. Michigan State forever kind of made, and we're talking a little recruiting angle here because it is National Signing Day. Michigan State's bread and butter was really sort of living in that like top 30 recruiter range where they found a lot of kids who were undervalued by other programs for whatever reason. Typically not like, hey, you know, sexual assault reasons. Like that's not, I'm not talking about like use that as a marketing inefficiency, obviously. I'm talking about like other reasons, you know, kid was undersized or something like that. And they did a really good job of developing those kids, and they won a heck of a lot of ball games, and then they got stomped by Alabama there in that playoff game, and it sort of reinforced, in my opinion, what their ceiling was. And that was the 2016 playoff, I think.
Yeah, or I think it was the 2016 January, something like that. Or because 2015 they made the Rose Bowl or won the Rose Bowl. I'm not entirely straight on the chronology there, but yes, that time frame.
Okay, so that was the Bama team that lost at Clemson, because Clemson won 16 and 18, right? And then yes. Bama won 17 and then 19, LSU just won.
Yes.
Okay. So Michigan State realizes it needs to get more talent out there. Some of these kids they took, it was very well known that there were some issues there, especially with the Robertson kid. And like, they try to up their talent level kind of by any means necessary, and it really bit him in the ass. I mean, and these weren't like, you know, school-run kangaroo court type verdicts. Like, these are like real charges, like in real court, you know? Like, I mean, you're talking about stuff where you actually have the opportunity to present evidence and present a defense and whatnot, and like real charges, real convictions. So you have that going on. Then you have Blackwell suing the university because they let him go for what they claimed was some changes in camp recruiting rules, and they had the opportunity to hire somebody who they thought was better for the job, and Blackwell is presenting himself here as the fallout guy, and we have all this testimony from some of the depositions coming out.
Right, because this is, and what Bud is getting at is the last 14 or 15 months of this deal. So they fire Blackwell in May, and then Blackwell turned around and sues D'Antonio. He sues the former AD and he sues the former president on wrongful termination grounds. They fired a guy who knows where the bodies are buried, for lack of a better term, or who would know, in Blackwell. And when you do that, when you give someone a motive to sue you, he is going to do, I mean, this thing is pretty nasty. I mean, the lawyers are sniping over like the length of depositions and whether or not, I believe whether or not like Blackwell's people like leaked a sealed deposition at one point in time that was unsealed and then resealed. So basically what happened hours before D'Antonio steps down is Blackwell's lawyers say that Blackwell would be willing to file an affidavit saying that D'Antonio orchestrated employment for the parents of two Michigan State football players with a mega donor, and that D'Antonio had Blackwell come with him on a recruiting trip, which would be a violation because Blackwell was not actually an on-field coach. All of this is going on surrounding the end of the Mark D'Antonio era, and all of this kind of, this is the end tail, this is the end of what had previously been the most successful 15-year stretch of Michigan State football since like the 60s. But the end of it is the end. This is the end of the story and the end of why, part of the reason why Mark D'Antonio steps down. There's just a lot going on here, and it's a lot more than just Mark D'Antonio wanted to spend more time with his family. You know, D'Antonio said that, you know, this has nothing to do with why he's leaving, but it's really, really hard. And I'm kind of processing the news or how I feel about the news kind of in real time here. It's just hard for me to sit and say Mark D'Antonio resigns the day before signing day, hours after Curtis Blackwell's lawyers file this, and I'm just supposed to take that at face value. I don't know. But I do want to ask you, just from like a lawyer perspective, like, how nasty do these things kind of get? Because Mark D'Antonio got deposed, and there's a really good Detroit news story about this whole deal that also says that Mark D'Antonio, the school, and Blackwell don't really have designs to settle this, which is another thing.
So I never practiced employment law, I'll say it off the bat, but when you have two sides that really seem to dislike each other and don't have a whole lot of motivation to settle, if that's what you believe. Now, then it can get pretty nasty. Of course, leaking some of this information can be a little bit of a warning shot that, hey, like, we're willing to go the distance with this if you don't want to settle this. Oftentimes, schools and any kind of government offices, they don't settle stuff oftentimes because they realize that, like, it's much easier, especially if this is like an elected position where the person making the decision has decided to settle or not. It's just kind of easier to say, oh, the crazy jury verdicts in courts, right? Whereas right. If you settle it, it admits weakness in some ways. But this certainly could get ugly. It very much ties into if a new coach takes this position. For instance, let's say that if there was evidence that what Blackwell is claiming is true about the employment for the parents of recruits that Michigan State ended up signing, that would be an NCAA violation. Now, this is something that happens all the time. Like, you and I both know of some kids whose parents got big-time promotions, like from the floor of the stock room to, like, four levels up managing the whole floor quickly. And it's a normal thing that happens, and I root for it to happen because, hey, man, like, if you played any other sport, you could probably just get a check. That'd be a little bit easier.
Right. And you could and the kid could take care of his parents. Yes.
Right. Exactly. So, but that could be a violation. You could, if proven true, you could have some sort of restrictions on your recruiting, which would impact the attractiveness of the job, at least in the short term, which does kind of bring me to a point. Like, I think if you're a really proven head coach, a guy who's done a really good job and is going to have options, if you take Michigan State, you're going to say, hey, give me a Matt Rule Baylor style deal.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't want a 5-year contract. I want a 7-year contract that's close to 90% guaranteed because
big,
I want it to be so painful.
Capital G, baby.
Yeah. And and you know what? It's not about just I want to cash in on their lack of leverage. It's also, this might take me a minute.
Yeah.
Right? I want to make sure that I have it. Like, it's painful enough for them to fire me that they're going to give me that kind of time to rebuild this thing that I need. Because the rest of the East does not appear to be slowing down.
Exactly. And if you come in and in 6 months, you've got 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 less scholarships over the next 3 years, you are not going to keep up with the Joneses that are Michigan, that is Penn State, and Ohio State. You are going to get left behind, no questions asked.
Exactly right. So, okay, since 2010, here are the win totals in the league for Michigan State. All right, ready for this? 7-7-3, 8-7-7, 1-7-5-4. You're probably averaging like 6-2 a year in the league over the last decade. I mean, I think, right?
That's roughly
14, yeah. 17, 25, 39, 40, 52, 56 over 10 years. So it's like I think if I did that right. So you're talking about 5.5 and 2.5 on average.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do. And it's probably even harder now that they actually, they switched divisions, right? Yeah. Because it used to be leaders, legends, and they were actually in sort of the easier side.
Is that when they were winning the league, it was leaders and legends?
So, correct. Yeah. They went 7-1, 7-1, 3-5, and 8-0 when it was leaders, legends.
Yeah.
Since the shift to divisions, 7-1, 7-1, but then 1-8, 7-2, 5-4, 4-5.
Right. Right.
By the way, I think we were wrong about the 2016 playoff team. being the one, I think it was the 2015 playoff team that lost to Alabama, because in 2016 they went 3-9 overall, which is not, but it actually fits the narrative even more. They have an awesome year, 2015. Bama stomps them out, and then they say, hey, if we're going to compete on this level, we got to have a better quality of talent. They end up taking a couple character reaches. Those character reaches all bite them in the ass almost immediately, too. I mean, like within months of being on campus.
Yeah.
Or weeks in some cases. I would want a significant guaranteed deal because I do feel like this can be a really nice job. Okay, their facilities are nice. They're clearly very much committed to winning. Their division is very tough, but I would want a guaranteed deal that gives me the length to do something here.
What's nice, quickly, before we get to the SPAP and questions, what's nice here? Are we talking, you know, are we talking 9-3? Are we talking, like, how many times, if I gave you, let's say you don't, no NCAA violations end up coming. Let's say, you know, you have carte blanche for 5 years. How many times do you win in the East in 5 years?
Ooh, a half? I mean, like, if I put the over-under at a half.
Yeah.
I'm not real confident going over or under. I mean, you have Ohio State, which is competing with, like, Georgia, Bama, LSU, Clemson on a recruiting trail. Michigan is not taking that next step, but they're not slowing
down necessarily.
But they're
still, right, it's still 10 wins every year.
Yeah, and Penn State is still recruiting very well. I mean, 3 out of the last 4 years in the East, you finished 4th, 5th, 6th.
Yeah.
One tie for second. I mean, there's been a little bit of a shift there.
And apparently Indiana got a little something-something to them now, too. So
yeah, that's they're doing a good job there.
Right. That's going to eat into, you know, your top line here. I don't know. When I think about candidates for this job, I think, like, if I'm a candidate for this job and it's February and, you know, I don't know. I don't know if now would be the time to take the Michigan State job. Beyond the fact that it is a Big Ten job, what carrot does that job currently have in its cap? Or what feather in the cap does that job currently have?
Yeah, I mean, it's as far as like ability to win the Big Ten, it is certainly, for instance, do you think it's easier to win the Big Ten at Michigan State or at Wisconsin? I think Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, that's 100%.
Because of your path,
right?
Right. Nebraska or Michigan State? Probably Nebraska.
I think if you're in the, I think it's in the West. The West. If you're in the West, give me the West. I'll figure it out against Wisconsin, and I'll figure it out against Minnesota. But right, those two teams, they just, and I'm not even talking on my ass here. At what point in time does Wisconsin and Minnesota scare you in any way, shape, or form, like Penn State or Ohio State or Michigan?
There's a level of athlete those schools in the West don't get as frequently on their football teams as some of the teams in the East do.
Also, and this is the last thing before we kind of get to the ask questions, but if I'm coming in here, you want to talk about the 2020 schedule? And I know last week I fucking railed against scheduling, but scheduling conversations, but let's talk about the schedule next year. You go September 26th, you play Miami, then you go Iowa, Michigan, Ohio State, Indiana, Minnesota, Penn State in a row. There's a bye week before Penn State. That also includes, on September 12th, a road trip to BYU. It's not a cakewalk in year one either. So Michigan State, there may be a pretty hard and fast drop-off for Michigan State coming quite soon, and it's a situation where the bottom of it might really fall out, and potentially D'Antonio was kind of keeping that thing together as best he could or as best anybody could, given the situation, and the bottom might fall out on this thing.
It really could bottom out before it gets better. I mean, that's why I keep going back to I'm not going to try to equate the scale of the wrongdoing at Michigan State football with Baylor football, right? Because I think it's pretty clear Baylor was longer, more systemic, et cetera, at least as far as what we know. But like
As far as football is concerned.
Yes, correct. Yeah. I want to make that clear. Football only. But Baylor had to bottom out, right? And Matt Rhule did a really good job there. It's certainly possible that that a similar arc could happen at Michigan State. And look, Baylor was back, I think, under Matt Rhule faster than I thought they were going to get back. I mean, probably faster than other people too. Man, I don't want to say everybody. Maybe some people really, really believed how fast he could do that. I didn't think he'd have him in the Big 12 title game this fast.
The one thing that I think that Baylor had in their favor, obviously, was that Texas hadn't really gotten it figured out. Like, Texas never really got it figured out since Matt Rhule's been there. Obviously, Oklahoma's been, you know, at the top. But they didn't really have to worry about – I mean, they were beating Texas. They didn't have to worry about the Texas at the top line of that conference. And also, there's no division, so you're not in potentially an unequally weighted division. But, okay, so we'll transition to SPAP in here, and we'll use the first one as kind of a transition here with recruiting, because I do think it's – it is something that we need to think about in all of this is the young men who thought they were going to play for Mark D'Antonio at Michigan State. At MU Engineer asks, how betrayed do recruits feel when something like D'Antonio happens, when a coach retires, gets fired, leaves right around signing day? Are there a bunch of recruits in disarray tonight trying to reevaluate their choice? If they committed to Michigan State, have they had other offers rescinded that are no longer options?
Great question. Let's go ahead and take this sort of one by one. I'm sure a number of them probably feel pretty betrayed because they think that there was some purposeful timing of this by D'Antonio, right? I'm sure they think, okay, what happened between today and December that caused you to have to wait for this and didn't give me a heads up? Now, we just discussed a lot of things happened, like right. Depositions happened and leaked, you know, stuff that's now out there in the media happened. But yeah, I'm sure there absolutely are some are pretty betrayed. Are there a bunch of recruits in disarray tonight? I think that will largely depend on what happens with their assistants, right?
Right.
Like, you only have so much relationship with the head coach. Most of your relationships are going to be with the assistants, with some of the staff. If that staff is retained, I don't think that they'll be in as much disarray, although some probably will. If they committed to Michigan State, have they had other offers rescinded that are no longer options? Yes, absolutely. Other schools fill up, and if Michigan State signed you, another school is going to take you off their board, and they're going to have to pursue another prospect, and that's certainly an issue there. Now, I want to make it clear here. Kids are not let out of their letters of intent by rule. Like, there's no automatic rule. I've actually proposed this before in articles on Banner Society and previously SB Nation. Like, hey, if a head coach leaves, my proposal is always this. You should be able to designate three key people in your recruitment on the staff, right? And if any of those people leave before you enroll in the school, you should be able to get out of your letter of intent.
Now, basically, head coach, basically what you're saying is you want to designate kind of primary recruiters. For sort of if you go on anybody's 247 page recently, it'll say primary and secondary recruiter of a, you know, a top 247 kid.
Right. So I think it should be your head coach, the coordinator on the side of the ball that you and the staff agree you'll play, and then you can either pick like your position coach or like your area recruiter, whoever you had the best relationship with.
Right.
That way, I think this would actually be a decent compromise, although schools would never do it because they don't have to compromise at all. But I think this would be a good compromise in that it would allow some protection for the school so it's just some random kid can't be like, oh, well, the DB coach left. I'm leaving.
I want to leave, yeah.
Well, dude, you play offensive line. So that seems kind of like a cop-out, right? You know, I think this would be a cool compromise. I really do. Now, schools won't do it, I don't think, because they have no incentive to do so right now. But the only real way these kids are let out of their letters of intent typically is via like a PR campaign. They have to get out there. They have to say, hey, this was nonsense. This is unfair. And they have to make it a negative for the school. In this case, I guess that if kids want out, Michigan State will probably let them out because they don't want to have more publicity brought on the reasons why D'Antonio stepped down or the potential reasons why he stepped down. But yeah, it's not automatic that these kids will be let out of their letters of intent simply because their head coach left, as much as it probably should be. So to the answer to the question, like, have they had other offers rescinded? Yeah, if they signed, 100% of their offers are rescinded because they can't go anywhere unless they're actually let out of their letters of intent.
Yeah, in 2020, the PR aspect is, I think, what's really interesting. In 2020, there's a difference in PR that schools actually care about than there was in 2005 if this happened. There is the shift in audience response, in audience kind of ingesting of this information, like when a coach leaves for another school, it's just a little bit different, and schools have to kind of deal with that. You know, we are about to see in like mid-February, there is still a shift in assistant pools. Not from a money perspective, but from a just guys going different places. The post signing day, assistant going to the NFL or assistant going to a different school is still very real in this sport. It's one of the underlying worst things that happened is, you know, for the last two and a half years, you've been talking to one coach and then that coach leaves. That still happens. So the other thing is with the early signing period, let's divorce ourselves with the context of D'Antonio leaving first and foremost. But if I am a head coach looking to retire, leave, whatever, when is the time to do it? Because if you leave December 1st, you've got now because of the other signing period or the signing period, you know, that's its own thing. If you leave, it's hard to leave in January because that's kind of the tail end of the recruiting period. You leave the day before signing day, it's not great. You leave the day after signing day, it's not great. You know, you could pull a Bob Stoops and leave in June, but then there are some other organizational things that you have to deal with. Is there a good time to leave your program as a head coach?
There's not really a good time to leave your program, no. That's a great point. Like you can identify somebody who's getting the short end of the stick pretty much any time of the year, right? And that sucks. The best way to remedy this, and it's not a timing issue, it's to let players out of their letters of intent automatically, I think, right? Yeah. But there is no best time. I mean, now if you could do it, if you could say, hey, like, I don't know, October 1. Like, hey guys, I want to let you know I'm not leaving like right this minute, but this is my last year.
Honestly, the Spurrier. Right? If you pull a Spurrier, now I know Spurrier left, but right. If you pull a Spurrier and not actually leave, if you pull a Spurrier and say, "Hey, I'm leaving,"
and you announce, yeah, almost like one of those farewell tours, like for instance, Bud Foster this year. Everybody knew that was going to be his last year in baseball. Like CeCe Sabathia had one
Derek
of those,
Jeter,
right?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I think that would be a good way to do it because you could also start your coaching search very early.
Yeah.
And kind of get the jump on everybody.
Get a jump and you can kind of do it kind of out in the open and where you don't have to like screw anybody over or anything like that. And to be honest, not a ton of recruiting is really done during the season anyway. So in a sense of like FaceTime and that kind of stuff. So you kind of can get away with it if you kind of leave, you know, October 1 or something like that, or announce it October 1. You do kind of punt the back half of the season. But, you know, the other thing is maybe you reinvigorate the team and they play for you and you get your send off, whatever. We'll stay in the Big Ten for the next question that comes from @CountryCodes11. Is a CFP berth the only thing between James Franklin and a top five recruiting class at Penn State? Can he get to the playoff without a top five class? And separately, what programs or coaches have the clout to be top five without on-field top level success? I'll take this from first because I think fans think that players care more about on-field success than they really do. I'm talking from like a player's perspective. I mean, it's a level of hubris. It's a level of pride. But as a player's perspective, I've been the shit my entire career. Middle school, likely peewee ball, high school. I've been the sun, moon, and stars. I've been it. I feel confident in my own ability, no matter what position I play, that I'm going to go to whatever school and I'm going to be the one that turns it around. Me and my boys in this class are going to be the ones that turn it around. Every single recruiting class thinks they are going to be the recruiting class that turns it around for whatever school they are going to. They think they are going to take that school to the top. So results both do and don't matter. But I don't think results on the field, I guess I'm kind of talking about top-level programs more than anything, but I don't think top-level programs' results matter as much as a lot of people think they do.
I think that's largely true, with the one exception of, like, if the results are so poor that, like, it leads to the idea that perhaps the staff won't be there throughout your tenure.
Like, if USC goes 2-10.
Sure, exactly. You know, or if USC, I don't know, maybe we'll get to that question in a second there. So how does Penn State get to a top five recruiting class? First of all, Pennsylvania is not the state it used to be as far as talent. I mean, a lot of that part of the country does not have the same talent that it used to have. I do think actually a more attractive offense to play in would be helpful. Penn State has largely been a better defensive team than it has been an offensive team in the last couple of years. You know, what's the one difference there in Ohio State and the other two big programs in Michigan and Penn State in that league? It's scoring points. They all play pretty damn good defense. Ohio State actually plays a fun, exciting offense to play in. Although Michigan's got better down the stretch, and Penn State has had one prior. Just last 2 years have been, what, like good but not amazing necessarily?
Yeah, it's been fits and starts. The last Moorhead year and then the Ronnie year this year, it's, you know, it's been fits and starts. They've been trying to figure it out.
There's some fan fiction here if you want to go back and go back. What if they somehow managed to hold on to Justin Fields the year that he took off and all of a sudden tore up the opening and became, you know, a real contender for the number one player in the whole nation?
And flipped to Georgia, like, yeah.
Yeah, he flipped to Georgia. Like, if they had kept him, he was probably dynamic enough and would have resonated enough with some of the other top kids that that really, I mean, maybe you get a couple more kids to follow you that year and maybe Penn State does end up with the top five class. Can he get there to the playoff of that top five class? Absolutely. Yes, guys, there are a ton of teams out there who get to the playoff who don't sign top five classes. Win the playoff? A little tougher. Getting to the playoff? No doubt. I mean, talk to Washington, talk to Michigan State, talk to Wisconsin, talk to Oregon. Right, exactly. A lot of teams can get there. Can you actually win? You know, I mean, Oklahoma has not had a whole lot of top five recently, but they do get there. What teams or coaches have the clout to be top five without on-field top-level success? All right, well, I'll start in Aggieland because Jimbo's done it before. So I guess he does have the on-field success, not at A&M.
Not current. I mean, but it's been 4 years.
Right. If he's engaged, you know, and like actually focused and is motivated to do the job, the guy's a hell of a recruiter.
Yeah.
And he has all the money in the world there at A&M. I'm not talking about like dropping bags money in the world, but like as far as the ability to hire staff and go out and
I mean, the guy's on a 10-year, whatever, $77 million deal, whatever it is.
Correct.
Guaranteed.
Yeah, there's some job security there, to be sure. So I think Jimbo would be one of the names. Trying to think who else here for sure. Within the SEC, Mullen has not gotten there, but I think he has enough success there where I feel like it's possible. You know, like I think their class is actually pretty nice. They didn't have the finish that they wanted to today, just in the last like hour that we've been taping this. I don't know if you've been on Twitter, but overall, I think he maybe could be one of the guys that could bust through. I'm trying to think who else here. Is there anybody I'm missing here off the top of my head? Oregon could land a top five class potentially.
Yeah.
But their class this year was pretty darn good. It's not. They're like one more big time class away from probably like busting through on the blue chip ratio.
Yeah. Do you think who? I know you haven't crunched the numbers, but off the top of your head, who's going to be in it next year that had been close or just off the top of your head? I know you could be wrong when you actually do the numbers, but
probably A&M. I think Miami will probably be close to dropping out, but I'm not sure.
Like dropping out?
They might have just been a 1 year entry. But like they're not like way out of it. You know, just barely. I think Oregon is probably just going to be just shy. So looking back, I'm trying to think here. I think A&M was the one school that if they had another nice class put together that they would end up in it.
Right. Right. Interesting. Okay. At UF Mark 79 asks, any anticipated changing in signing periods, adding another early signing period before the season starts, eliminating or moving either of the current windows, I actually, and this was something that I was just going to ask you, so I'm glad he asked it. But, like, what do you think about early signing a few years in? We are now, what, 3 years into this? We have kind of the players who signed this year are truly, you know, early signing period babies in a sense of they know that they may have had to had a decision ready by mid-December or late December and it didn't catch anybody off guard. What do you think about just kind of how it's all played out now that we're 3 years in?
Yeah, I really don't like it. I wish that we would do an initial signing period before the start of the year.
Before for the kids, season.
Yeah. For the kids who truly have their stuff all together, who really know where they want to go, who have had their grades together and ready in order to be able to take spring and summer official visits, and who I think you would have a lot fewer kids making rush decisions if you pushed up the timeline even earlier there, because I think it would drastically cut down the number of kids who actually sign. And most of the kids you're going to sign, I think, early on are going to be your legacy kids, your studs who have you know, already had the ability to visit a lot of these schools and
quarterbacks.
See them. Yeah, quarterbacks will still go early. A lot of your really high academic kids who already know where they want to go. And then I don't really see the need for everybody to sign in December, right? We still have all these coaching changes going on. Why not push it back to the original date? For like, I would go August and then the same, you know, February, first Wednesday in February date. I think it provides more information for the players who don't have who did not have their minds made up in December. We had so many coaching changes following the early signing period yet again, and yet these kids are locked in, and I'm sure some of them would like to make different decisions if they could do it over again. They won't tell you that because that would be admitting fault, and most of these dudes don't do that. But I mean, it's really, I think it's disadvantageous to the kids, and I would like to see it moved, but I don't think it's going to move.
So you're saying we would move the December signing day to like late July or August.
Yes.
And we kind of get that done, and there would be no December signing day, and then there would be the same legacy February signing day that we've always had.
Yeah, exactly right. December. Now, look, if you're an early enrollee, you don't really even sign in December. You can just enroll
early enrollee for the spring semester. Early enrollees basically means a high school kid who basically graduates or at least finishes his high school curriculum at the end of his senior fall, and then
exactly
enrolls
right.
in whatever school in early January. That is very common in a sense of like every class, top level class, has like what, 5 to 10 of those kids every year.
Right, and that's the thing, man. Like, I just don't think.
That's also not new. Like, that's been going on for, you know, a decade and a half, roughly.
Right. Yeah. It's constantly going on. I don't see what the real benefit is to the kid for December. I know the coaches love it because they get it out of the way. They get to spend Christmas with their families. I mean, they're big fans of it.
When it was being proposed and talked about and all that stuff, were you in favor of December?
No. I've really been stuck with this, like the August and February system throughout. I did not anticipate this many kids signing early, though.
Because it's like 90.
I thought some would wait and weigh their options, but it's always their first time going through the process.
Yeah.
Now it's the school's third or fourth time going through it.
And it's like 90% of the top 247. I mean, I don't know if you know the number, but it's
a lot of
these kids have signed. The top kids have signed.
It's a ton.
By
the way, Will Muschamp is going to be at the ceremony today for his son, who's signing, Jackson, Jordan Birch, who is the big time defensive end who's committed to them but decided not to sign early and LSU's trying to get him to flip. This could be like epic pressure if he turns down Will Muschamp. And by the time you listen to this, this will already be done. But like, if he does decide to flip to LSU, which I don't think, that would be like the old, like, can you imagine that? You're the college head coach, you show up and the kid flips to LSU right in front of you, like next to the table with your son.
God, this sport's ridiculous. Okay.
It really is.
At RR5481 asks, what's the explanation behind Harbaugh losing his top recruiter, Charlie Partridge, to Ole Miss? Is this a bad sign of where the Harbaugh era is headed? That's one question. And then a question that I really want to get in with you is, what does James Coley and Malchaw headed going from Georgia to Texas A&M tell us about the direction of those recruiting staffs? Let's start with the Partridge to Ole Miss thing and Michigan.
So, two things. Number one, I don't really have a great answer for the Charlie Partridge to Ole Miss thing, other than the idea that, look, Ole Miss is very much all in on recruiting. They feel like they have got to get really elite level players to compete in the SC West. I don't disagree with them, by the way. Like, it is important to get good players. With the second question, James Coley leaving Georgia after they hired Todd Monken and the quarterback's coach from Southern Miss, I just think the writing there was sort of probably on the wall.
So you, having been around Florida State at the particularly the period you were around Florida State, what is Coley's real value to a staff? Because the experiment of him calling the offense did not work.
Right, and he left for Miami at least in part so that he could call plays down there.
Left Florida State for Miami.
Yes.
At the time.
Correct. So now he's back to being the tight ends coach at Georgia, or excuse me, at Texas A&M after calling plays last year for Georgia. I think Coley is a tremendous recruiter, like really is charismatic, very personable, nice dude. He connects with kids very well. His offenses have had very mixed results, right? Some of them have been, I think, pretty disappointing, and I think you would put some of that on him. And some of it maybe not, right? Like some of his Miami offenses, I think, had some real personnel and kind of culture commitment issues.
And I also
throughout the program.
I also do think you can't discount Kirby potentially having his hands on a level of pace of the offense, mm-hmm. or a level of, you know, let's call it thinking outside of the box for that offense. That also does not get to personnel and injuries that they had at Georgia with receivers and what Jake Fromm could or couldn't do, or how Jake Fromm potentially regressed from the Rose Bowl year without Sony Michel and Nick Chubb. Funny how that works to now.
Exactly right. We're going to learn a lot about Georgia this year.
Oh, yeah.
Because if this offense looks exactly the same, this is probably a Kirby Smart issue and not a James Coley issue. Now, Texas A&M has really been trying to beef up their staff with more and better recruiters. They ended up getting TJ Rushing from Florida State after he had been on campus only like 2 weeks. They go out and get James Coley. Coley's clearly a guy that Jimbo Fisher knows is an elite recruiter because he helped him build that 2013 national title team, at least in part. And then with Marshall Malchow, he's going to A&M. Like, that guy understands Georgia's recruiting operation. If you're Jimbo, you've been away from the mothership for a while, mm-hmm. right? Kirby was there with Nick much more recently. Maybe he wants a refresher on some of the new tactics that they're using. Because Georgia just signed the number one class today, by the way, again.
It hurts me. We will do Georgia all offseason. Trust me. But the one thing for Georgia as it moves into potentially a new era is it boggles my mind that Georgia would sign Newman and bring in Munkin, and that Kirby would not let the team transition into something that's a little bit more modern. Kirby has seen it done, at least in the beginning, at Bama, and seen what opening the system up can do for your team when you are so, so good. I digress. At TanMan128 asks, what's the most confusing / no one knows what's going on recruiting saga that you can remember for one player, and how does everything that has happened with Zach Evans compare to that? Zach Evans, 5-star running back, signed at Georgia, and I mean basically backed out. Georgia let him go. And we'll get to that. But I have a sort of a funny story about sort of like this, stuff like this. Me and you were actually at the Under Armour All-American game. This was when I was still in college. And Dalvin Cook at the time obviously ended up signing with Florida State, but Florida was in on him at that time. This is New Year's weekend or whatever that year. Florida had just gotten his buddy Ermin Lane, or at least thought they had his buddy Ermin Lane coming to Florida. I was literally talking to Dalvin Cook's grandmother and asking her, you know, how the recruitment was going and interviewing her and, you know, what's Dalvin going to do? Is Dalvin going to flip to Florida, et cetera, et cetera? Unbeknownst to me, Dalvin Cook was on ESPN set taping his commitment to Florida during Under Armour practice. And I get upstairs and the news has been leaked out and I'm transcribing an interview of Dalvin Cook's grandmother saying she doesn't know what's going on. And Dalvin Cook, the news was coming out on Twitter that Dalvin Cook was going to be a Florida State Seminole. So that's my no one knows what's going on story. I know you have, Lord knows how many you have.
Betty knew.
Yeah.
I think Betty knew.
Yeah.
Or I don't know if Betty knew that it was going to go down that day on ESPN, but oh man, there's a lot of good ones. Shoot. Okay.
That's how I got as a student newspaper or as a student reporter.
Zach Evans may be the best one yet.
Yeah.
Because I mean,
take us through what's actually happened there.
Okay, so like there's numerous schools that he has silently indicated he's going to go to. This is a kid who is the best, like talent-wise, he's the best running back in the nation. There's really no doubt. He plays for Houston North Shore High School. He got suspended twice this year. The last time the media reports down there basically said like he was the only one who refused to turn in his cell phone before the high school state title game. The rest of the team did. It's sort of like a solidarity thing and like a focus thing. Probably like a hope these kids go to bed thing, right? Before the, you know, before the state title game. So he gets suspended and North Shore wins anyway.
Jesus.
Allegedly, he was going to commit to Georgia earlier in the year, but then it was basically said, like, hold off because he got suspended the first time and, like, they didn't want to. It's just not a great look to, like, commit right after you just got suspended for the first time and then the second time as well. He never even took an official visit to Georgia, yet signed with Georgia in the early signing period. And literally, depending on who you believe, either Georgia declined to submit his letter of intent or he decided to get cold feet again and backed out. And we know that Bama doesn't want to take him, which is incredible because I'm telling y'all, like, this kid is one of the best running back prospects talent-wise that you'll ever see. There's a lot going on with this recruitment, a lot of moving parts, a lot of people involved. He is an amazing interview, by the way. He gave me like 12 minutes that were just completely all over the board. I'm talking about just like contrasting answers back-to-back sentences. It was amazing.
It's funny when you interview recruits, it's – there obviously it's kind of a spectrum because some of them are already in the vein of like some of them are tired of the process, honestly. Some of them are so worn out with the process that they like don't want to give you anything or don't feel that they can give you anything. Some of them are like already in the like coach speak vein already. Some of them will tell you kind of what you want to hear if you're, you know, working for this team site or that team site. If I came to you as a Florida team site writer, you may tell me that Florida's in my top three or Florida's in your top three because, you know I work for a Florida website, but then you tell the LSU website and the Georgia website and the South Carolina website the same thing. So it is funny when you interview these kids.
Well, okay, so remember when we talked about, hey, like if somebody signed with Michigan State, would they have options off the table? Here, other schools did take commitments from players because they thought that he had signed with Georgia, which he had, but Georgia did not turn the letter of intent in. Now, he can't sign another letter of intent. Zach Evans is just going to enroll somewhere at some point. Now, he's already graduated from school. He's an early enrollee. So for the most schools, it's too late for him to enroll for like January, you know, starting spring semester. But if he picks a school on the quarter system, he could still enroll there to one of those schools.
So the other thing is, very quickly, you don't have to sign a letter of intent. And
correct.
It behooves the best players in the country probably not to. But I know you've done work on this. Andy Staples, now at The Athletic, did some stuff on this when he was at SI. What was it? Demetrius Robertson?
Yes, the Georgia receiver who ended up signing with Cal initially. Now, he transferred back to Georgia, but he did sign with Cal. He waited and never signed. We've had a couple of guys.
I guess is the nomenclature. Didn't sign, just shows up on campus.
Who was the backer for the Georgia who got drafted by the Bears?
Roquan?
Yeah, Roquan, now he did not delay his thing a whole lot, but he did not end up signing a letter of intent, I believe. I will note, you can only sign one letter of intent. Like, so even if you get let out of it, you can't sign somewhere else, but you can just enroll somewhere else. So that's the situation with Evans. If I was trying to get paid out as a recruit, I would wait and wait and wait and wait because the desperation grows.
And particularly with the portal now, you may get a portal kid that leaves – in April or spring practice or whatever in June, and now you're really screwed. And if I'm a kid and I'm not graduating until May or June anyway, graduating high school until May or June anyway, it may behoove to hold out and figure it out. But I do want to ask, so Evans won't sign again. What happens? He just shows up?
He just says, hey, I'm going to enroll at your school, and a school says, awesome. He may sign some financial aid papers with them or something like that. Now here's a scenario for you. Florida, who has had a really nice, I would say, last 6 weeks of recruiting, done a really nice job. A little bit of a kind of a crash, not crash. They missed on their top two kids today in Gibbs and Avante Williams, who shockingly picked Miami. I did not see that coming. Nobody on the 24/7 Sports crystal ball did either. They all 15 were to Florida, so the relationship with Miami staff apparently won out there. And Gibbs is a running back who I think is really good. He ended up sticking with Jeff Collins. After, by the way, people at the All-America Bowl told me that he had introduced himself as uncommitted because he was one of those kids that didn't sign early on with Georgia Tech despite being committed. If you're Florida, don't you try to get in on Zach Evans? Like you trust your locker room and your culture enough that you feel like you can bring that kid in there and he's not going to mess up your locker room? I think you go after him.
Yeah, and you know Florida did obviously bring in transfer Lorenzo Lingard, who's going to need a waiver to play, I think. So we'll see.
And I
want to
know if he's healthy or not. Like, he was freaky athletic in high school. I know he blew the knee at Miami. Like, if he's healthy, he could be a really, really nice help for the Gators. It'll be interesting to see who continues to go after Evans. I know Tennessee's been after him. I know Ole Miss has been after him. A&M maybe out of spots. I need to check on that. I don't know if he's actually going to sign announce where he's going today.
When you say out of spots, you mean like literally, I mean, it can't take anybody because they're capped out.
Correct.
Yeah. Kids. Yeah. Yeah. And the numbers get weird because when you have early enrollees, you can back count them. And when you've got players that leave for the draft and scholarship math is its own science, truly.
Exactly.
Okay. So at Kivbot asks, can you expand on what role high school coaches play in college recruiting? Is it just talking to college recruiters about upcoming players, or do they get involved in the Bagman network too? I'm just going to let you go here because this is your expertise.
Sure. So they absolutely talk to college recruiters about their players, but man, there's a lot of it here. Like a lot of times the mail gets sent to the player's school and not even the player's house sometimes, right? And the coach will talk to the player about it. You'll give it to the player. Hey, man, like this is one you shouldn't throw away. You should take a look at this. Like a lot of times the kids want to bounce questions off the coaches. A lot of times, Richard, these kids don't have reliable transportation to camps and campuses and whatnot. And so oftentimes it's not the parent taking them on these visits. A lot of times it's the high school coach taking them on these visits. And so within that, there is a little element of the Bagman game going on, of course. A lot of times high school coaches will get some gas money to take a player up there. That's not really within the rules. But sometimes they'll get a lot of gas money, like for a boat, or maybe maybe get that jet fuel money, you know? And that's fine, man. Like, I don't know, my state, Florida, I'm rooting for those coaches to get that because the starting pay for these high school teachers who are also football coaches in Florida is embarrassingly low.
Right.
To the point where we got good high school coaches in Florida leaving for the state of Georgia because they're getting paid about double.
That is a subplot to why Georgia is getting so good. It's a subplot to why edgewise Florida is eroding. And particularly it's a subplot to why some of these players come out and they're greener than they otherwise would be, or more wet behind the ears than they otherwise would be. Because if I'm a smart, talented, whatever high school coach, I'm going to go to Georgia. I'm going to go to Texas. I'm not necessarily going to go to Florida because of the pay for all of how good Florida high school football is. It boggles the mind that the pay has not come up to, you know, I guess market rate is the best way to say it.
Adding to that, it has created a power vacuum somewhat in that some of these kids now latch on to their 7-on-7 coaches even more, some of whom are awesome and really have like the kids' best interest at heart, and some of whom perhaps are not quite as much. I don't know. We saw some of those dudes walking around the coaching convention.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
Yes. Okay.
So, yeah.
Last one from Mick Bricks. Is Kevin Sumlin doing anything noteworthy in recruiting? He had success in Arizona when at Texas A&M. Sumlin's doing some noteworthy stuff in recruiting, but it is not in a good way. You brought Kevin Sumlin in to dominate Phoenix and extend into California. He got really good players. Christian Kirk comes off the top of my head from Phoenix to go to Texas A&M. That was one of the things where it was like, okay, we brought someone in. We think we're going to start dominating recruiting. They have stayed roughly where they were in the Rich Rod era /backslid a little bit. But I don't know if you disagree with that. you know, I think the issue is what he's not doing. I know he came in after Spencer Rattler committed to Oklahoma, but were there overtures to flip him? Were there overtures to try to get him out of that Oklahoma commitment?
I think he knew that there was no shot there. I mean, realistically, like Oklahoma just produced two Heisman winners in a row. And like he was their handpicked guy. So in this class, Kevin Sumlin does not have a player ranked in the national top 600.
Oh.
Last year they had two, but nobody inside the national top 550. Previous year they had one, Nathan Tilford, who was a top two, like 225 kid, and then one other dude inside the top 500. Look, yeah, it's not going well there. Arizona State is doing a much better job than they are.
And that's absurd to think of. I mean, the thing was that Herm was not going to be able to get it figured out, that Herm was going to get left behind, that I was there the year or the summer that Herm got hired, and they were worried that they were, you know, going to get left in recruiting, but also that Arizona had a schedule that set Arizona up for success quicker, and that that was why they were going to get left behind, because Arizona was going to start outstripping them in a potential future. Bud, why is Bijan Robinson not an Arizona Wildcat? I mean, this is one of the best running backs in the country, grew up in Tucson, or at least played high school in Tucson.
I think he's just, I don't want to say this in a way that's going to make people think I don't like Arizona, because I have no problem with the University of Arizona. He's too good to stay in the state. look at the history of kids in Arizona. If you're really, really, really good, you leave the state.
And he's going to Texas.
Yeah, exactly. Like, those Arizona schools were not serious options for him. I don't think. That's just the thing that happens. Like, Arizona and Arizona State, they're at different levels of success right now in terms of, like, last year. But overall, they're similar in that neither have ever won anything really big. Not in our lifetimes.
Right.
And
I don't think Arizona's ever been to the Rose Bowl. That's the thing. They've never been to the Rose Bowl. They've been in the Pac-12 since the 70s. Arizona State has done it once? Jake Plummer era?
Did they go Rose Bowl? Because I know they went Fiesta Bowl against like Ohio State.
Yes, that must have been what it was. Okay, it was Fiesta.
Because that was the year that Miami also had to beat UCLA to knock them out, and it was the Edgerrin James team.
You know what year that it was? Honestly, it was the year Florida won the national title because they beat Ohio State.
They did go to the Rose, dude.
Yeah, okay.
they went to the Rose, 96. You're right.
Yeah, that's the year they beat Ohio State and it helped Florida win the national championship that year. That's actually how I remember it. Okay, we'll stay on the West Coast because this is an AskPAPN from @RJ_writes. It's USC time. Let's talk USC. We would be remiss on this show if we didn't. USC, this signing class, Jason Kirk is going to have, I believe, a read option newsletter coming really soon, probably by the time you hear this, about what this USC class is like in recent history. It boggles the mind that USC is going to have the signing class that they're going to end 2020 with.
It's crazy, man. But yet, if I told you that, okay, so a lot of us in the national media assume that Helton would be fired. And
it's, I mean, a lot of coaches out West.
That's
assumed
the point.
Helton was going to be fired.
Yeah, it wasn't just like all these national folks thought he was going to be fired and they were wrong. Yeah, they were wrong. They weren't the only ones that were wrong here. Local coaches, local media all thought there's no way he's going to last the season, especially not once JT got hurt. And I really believe that USC basically had to recruit this year with a head coach in Clay Helton who was perceived to be a lame duck coach. Now, USC ended up not making a move, which is pretty surprising. But this recruiting class, in my opinion, is a reflection of USC having to recruit with a guy that everybody thought would be fired. And they just never ended up firing him. So I do believe that a lot of the kids who probably would normally consider USC would have probably considered them if they had announced a new head coach in time for these kids to consider them. But like, they didn't happen because they didn't announce a coach at all. They kept Clay Helton. And if you recall, they waited and waited and waited to announce that he was going to stay. So I believe USC kind of kneecapped Clay Helton there as well by waiting so long to say, hey, we're not going to make a change.
Particularly because everybody kind of knew that there was going to have to be some staff turnover if you brought him back. Like, you weren't going to bring him back with the whole staff, particularly on defense, that kept Graham Harrell, which was huge. But, you know, when that staff turns over, it becomes another thing of the relationships aren't there. You're building up from scratch. You are already not the dominant power in recruiting. Like we've said on the show before, there was a time when if you were a good player west of the Rocky Mountains and USC wanted you to go to USC, you went to USC. And it's not like a drop in bag situation. It's USC, it. Everything. You go to USC. That has changed. Case in point, Kayvon Thibodeau does not play for USC. That is the one in just very recent history that always sticks out to me. There's no excuse that Kayvon Thibodeau is at Oregon and not at USC. Now, I know his recruiting played out a certain way, but just on its face, number one defensive end in the country from LA didn't go to USC.
Exactly. That's the deal, man. Like, I think there are some deeper-seated issues at USC as far as, like, does USC still think, hey, we can be USC without spending the kind of money that other schools spend now? Like, is that becoming an issue there? But I do believe that's secondary to keeping Clay Helton. And I'm not saying Clay Helton's a terrible coach or anything like that. I don't necessarily think that he's terrible. But I do believe that you have an issue where people thought he wasn't going to be there.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, I'll consider USC once this change is made, and the change was just never made.
Yeah. Yeah. As the world turns. But Elliot, we must first send our love to Stephen Godfrey. Stephen Godfrey has had his third child. The baby is here. Beautiful baby girl. We send our love to Godfrey and the whole family. Congratulations. We will see you back when you get back, hopefully as soon as possible. It'll probably be roughly the end of March or April when Godfrey returns to us. From then until, this is kind of going to be my show. It's dad is gone and I'm throwing a party. That party will unfortunately not include my guy here, Bud Elliott. Bud, enlighten us. Tell us what's going on.
Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure to do this show. I mean, we appreciate y'all embracing us. I know initially it was really tough without Bill. You know, I've been at Vox now for about a decade, and I appreciate y'all giving us the time to work on this thing. It's been awesome. Unfortunately, I am leaving the show, so it's going to be a Richard-led show now, especially until Godfrey comes back off paternity leave. Not going to say where I'm going, but you know, Jelani, thanks as well. And you guys, I really enjoyed doing this. You know, it was a whole lot of fun, and you'll see me somewhere else soon. And I know the show is going to continue to really be the powerhouse that it is and be an awesome listen. I'm going to keep listening.
Yeah. Bud is really special to me personally. In the last few months of this, doing this show have been a lot of fun as we've figured it out. You know, obviously halfway through the season, all three of us kind of came together and figured out, why are we doing two separate podcasts? Let's just do it with the three of us. And, you know, we've gotten good response and consistently, comprehensively, I do appreciate everybody who listens for reaching out, saying that they've stuck with the show, for sticking with the show as we continue to figure out formats. Bud is the reason I am at Vox Media. I'm not overstating it. I sat in my parents' living room a week before I was going to move to Bristol, Connecticut and work for ESPN. And Bud called me and said, SB Nation's hiring college football writers. We want you. And so began a process that quite literally has us both on this podcast right now. And me sitting in this seat in New York City in these offices. Bud is incredible. The way he views the sport, the way he views the world, honestly, is really fun. And it's fun to always sit and learn. And, you know, I never come out of a conversation with Bud about anything not being enlightened and not having my perspective changed in some way, shape, or form. And but I appreciate you. I cannot wait to see what's next for you and your whole family, man. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch you do your own thing for a little bit.
I appreciate it, man. I'll see you guys soon.
Absolutely. And I'll be back next week.